there. Thanks for coming. Take a seat.
It's time to retire to the drawing room.
Any historian will tell you that their job involves a fair degree of sleuthing, and that's especially true of the war historian. James Hirst has recently uncovered a letter by the last man to leave the firing lines at Gallipoli. He joins me along with Lynette Silver, one of Australia's most prolific World War II historians. Welcome to both of you. Lynette, you actually refer to yourself as a war detective on your website. What's the most important sleuthing lesson you would give to anyone interested in doing this kind of stuff in war history?
I think you need to be able to really think outside the square. Most of the work I've done over the years has been solved with because of an ability to think outside the normal ways you trace things, rather the same way as a detective on a murder hunt will really need to think outside the square if he's going to solve the case.
Can you give me an example of how you've applied this thinking outside the square to get a piece of information that's been crucial in telling a story?
Well, I might get stuck, totally stuck, and you go through the normal channels of things that are available through archives, and you get to a point where you can't go any further. So I then employ the technique of, well, what would have happened next? What would this person have done? And by doing that and going along that line is how I've solved a lot of the things happening in Borneo, which is one of my fields, particularly in relation to the rescue mission that failed over there to rescue the POWs. That was completely lost. The story was never recorded anywhere. It was simply by knowing enough about the story and getting in behind it that I found the paperwork which proved the case that the whole of the POWs that were still alive there had been abandoned because faulty intelligence had been collected, and it was a faulty intelligence that led to the collapse of the rescue mission.
James, do you agree with that, that thinking outside the box is crucial in good history sleuthing?
I imagine so. I'd add just having a dedicated interest in your material and just not wanting to give up has probably been more use to me. It's very easy just to look at the existing secondary sources or even throw in the occasional primary source and rewrite the story from that. And to a certain extent, Gallipoli, that's kind of what we've been doing for 100 years. The official historian wrote first two volumes in the 1920s from memory. I think that's a great foundation, but I think a lot of us over the last 100 years have used that as the gospel and therefore not really had a decent look at it. And what I've been doing for the last 30-odd years, I guess, is looking at primary sources and using them to reconstruct the story. Now, as Lynette will know, primary sources are fraught. People's memories are all over the shop, what they record is all over the shop, and so on. And so that's when you have to start going really into the detective work behind to try and work out what was going on.
Can we get to your recent discovery? What is the significance of the letter you found? Who wrote it and why is it important?
To my embarrassment, it's a recent discovery from 30 years ago, but I didn't actually solve the case until last year for the centenary. What had happened was a friend of mine, a colleague, loaned me a letter from his grandfather, who's a chap named James Alexander, and he was a company sergeant major in the 20th Battalion. And in this letter, he describes the last few days at Gallipoli. The last party was going to be about 1,500 men stretched all the way along the Anzac front, and Alexander appears to have been one of those. Now, the letter starts with him going to check on one of his posts, and when he gets there, he said he found two jabbering lunatics driven mad by a shell burst, and my corporal was nowhere to be found. So he sorted out the ones that were still alive, went rushing back with shovels to try and dig out the poor corporal. They started finding bits of him immediately, but never did find his head. Now, 30 years ago, of course, I went straight to the official histories and any other books I had on my bookcase and couldn't find any record of this. Alexander also describes going to an officer's dugout to find out about some other men of his and found the officer spread all over the floor and walls of the dugout by another direct hit. Again, I could find no record of this incident. And so various times over the last 30 years I've looked at it and had to shelve it, basically. Last year for the centenary, with this thing called the internet and so many more books on the campaign available, I gave it another crack. Straight away, the same old problems. None of the chronologies added up. None of it matched the official history. The dates weren't right, and so on and so on. And I eventually discovered the names and the dates for this event. But I've identified the officer that was spread all over the dugout. And I also identified the two 20th Battalion blokes who are in their mid-20s. And when I wrote this up, I left out all their names, of course, because I doubt to this day their family knows that their relation was buried without a head somewhere.
So basically, James, this letter turned out to be from the last man to leave the firing lines at Gallipoli.
He doesn't mention it as such, but when you do the detective work, it looks like he must have been. So this poor bloke, who had been manning the last position at Anzac, saw his men off to the beach And then he had to go out into no man's land for another half an hour on his own. As Lynette will know, you know, we don't know the whole story of anything ever, but if he was outside in front of the last post to be evacuated for half an hour after the last post was evacuated, it's inconceivable that he wasn't the last man to leave.
You've convinced me. I've read it.
Oh, good. Thanks, Lynette.
Lynette's endorsed that, so I reckon another historian endorsing that is pretty good. Do you have to have a strong stomach, Lynette? Is that part of the sort of ingredients of a good historian?
Oh, well, the work I do, you do, because I do a lot of war crimes against the Japanese. I've just finished working with a Japanese film crew, actually, on atrocities against Australians that's being shown on Japanese television. But when you get into war crimes, they're pretty graphic, and some of the things that happen are horrendous, you know, vivisections of downed pilots and people executed under terrible circumstances, you know, with a sharpened piece of spring from a car, for instance, that's been sharpened up to take their heads off. When I first started this and I read some of them, I thought, how on earth am I going to cope? And I thought, well, I'll just have to be like a judge in a court, listening to the evidence, going through the evidence and not get emotionally involved. And you really need to do that. And some of the things really are beyond the pale that I have to deal with. But I can't say I've got used to it over the years, but I've developed a stomach for it and an ability to just go through the confessions of Japanese and the war crime investigation and sort out the bits that you need to complete what is essentially a massive jigsaw puzzle with lots of bits missing. I disagree slightly with James over not making this information available, because even though I've discovered some terrible things happen to people in the work I do, the relatives always want to know. They say that what they imagine is far worse usually than reality, and quite often it is. And they've said to me that we have a right to know. Why should you know when we don't? Mm. So
that's really interesting.
I'll qualify that.
Yeah, James, why do you come from a bit of a different angle?
Oh, nobody's published the articles yet. So the idea was that I have those names up my sleeve, and if anyone was interested, I'd put it out at that point and see what the editors reckon and talk to some historian friends. Now I'm in touch with Lynette, I could ask her about these things.
On our end, Drive, you're in the drawing room, and we're going through history and the role that historians play in sleuthing and retelling history, history we may have missed or stories that are not part of our understanding. My guests are James Hurst, a Gallipoli historian, and Lynette Silver, a World War II war historian. Lynette, you mentioned Japanese interviews. What about accessing the war records of former enemy countries? Is this something we've done a lot of in the past? Is it a difficult process?
There's not a lot in Japan, but there is some, and there's an arrangement between Australia and the Japanese where we've got access to quite a bit of stuff now, but mostly the things I deal with are a result of investigations from our side into the Japanese. So we hold a lot of material here which is not in Japan. A lot of the things I deal with were such atrocious crimes that the Japanese certainly didn't want to take a record home with them. We only know about it because basically they were forced into confessions.
I remember my mother telling me they went down to Fremantle to greet some of the POWs returning, and she said to this day she can't forgive what was done to them on the basis of they just looked like skin and bone. And years later, when I was reading up about it, I could tell her that they'd probably been fattened up for 3 months before they came home as well. Would that be right, Lynette?
Yes, they were sent to the island of Labuan, just off the coast of Borneo, and they were put there into a big field hospital and fattened up. You know, some of them only 4 stone, which is the weight of a child.
Terrible.
And they were there for some time, then they were sent home. But even then, they weren't exactly fat.
How did you both come to this field of research? Was it your own family experience or just your own interest in war history? I'll start with you, James.
I really don't know. I've just always had a fascination for history. And for some reason, Gallipoli was always took number one spot. I don't know why. I remember back in primary school, all we ever heard about was Simpson and his donkey, for a start. And there were names on the war memorial on the way home. You know, how do you relate Simpson and his donkey to these names? What's going on? With Gallipoli in particular, there's so much writing that focuses on the myth and so on and so on, or rehashing the same old stories year after year. There's such a wealth of stuff behind that. But I guess I found it because I was looking for answers to questions. Specifically, I started with the 11th Battalion because of a friend of my grandmother. We had a photo of him in her rose garden in West Perth, which I remember from my childhood. And he went away and didn't come back. Luckily, there was a name on it, and I started chasing him up. And X number of years later, I had, you know, 500,000 words of research and spreadsheets and everything else, and still had nothing on him. But by then, of course, I'd discovered all these extraordinary other stories, and so most of them ended up in Game to the Last. So your short answer, sorry, is I really don't know. It's just always been a lifelong thing.
Well, it is. You've made it absolutely your career. Lynette, was there something that sparked your interest in taking this road? Was it a frustration, perhaps, that there were stories that weren't being told?
No, I started off doing colonial history, and I found I had a talent for finding things that other people couldn't, and found papers related to gold discovery in New South Wales that had been lost at that stage for 138 years. And when I did find them, and people were so amazed I'd found it, I did a book on that. Then I moved into Irish Insurrection in New South Wales back in 1804. And then basically by accident, I got interested in the raids on Singapore Harbour, which took place in 1943 and 1944, the second one of which claimed the lives of all 23 men involved. And in doing that and putting that together, I kept on going, and I developed an interest in the Second World War in Singapore, why it fell, then that led to POWs, and then that led me down to Borneo and to into the area of that, of course, which is a great atrocity, because out of the 2,500 POWs who were sent across to Sandakan, only 6 survived the war. So it was the worst atrocity in Australia's history from the Second World War. In doing that and putting together the list for the very first time of everybody involved and what had happened to them, and tracing 2,200 sets of remains all across Borneo and finding out where they ended up, I kind of got very, not bogged down, but very involved in that. I'm still doing it, and I go over regularly and take groups across for Anzac Day purely on a voluntary basis, and also take them across the Death March track in Borneo, which I managed to relocate by going back to the primary evidence, and with an expert in jungle trekking, we put together the track, which now people are walking along for about 6 days, a distance of about 100 kilometres, just the last bit. So far from being just something I was just doing from interest, it's turned sort of into a life mission, I guess.
It sounds like it's bigger than your career, it's your entire life's mission. Why are these intricate, detailed and often personal accounts of war history so important? I suppose especially when all the players have died. What do they offer future generations? James?
Thinking while Lynette was talking, I was thinking back to those days of reading up about, you know, Sandakan and the POWs of the Japanese and so on, and even Vietnam and so on. And I think the common ground is the human experience. It's how on earth do people cope with that kind of stuff, whether we're talking about Gallipoli or the POWs. And I suspect that's the common ground between what Lynette and I do, is just this awe that people can, what people can do in times of crisis, the way they band together, the way they survive, is really part of the extraordinary part for me. And I think it's, to me, you need to get into the detail to carve the picture, because it's so easy to resort to the secondary sources and the mythological versions and just skimming over the top. And it's the detail that builds both the personal experience picture and also the actual historical picture. My thesis on the Gallipoli landing started off as a master's, just tracing the people of one battalion, the 11th Battalion. It ended up becoming a PhD because things weren't adding up. And the only way to solve outstanding questions from the last 100 years was to get into the intimate detail of half a dozen blokes or a dozen blokes, or one if that's all you've got, and actually try and put that together and flesh out what actually happened as opposed to what we thought happened. And you suddenly realise there are huge gaps in the chronologies, or three events have been drawn into one in the official history or whatever, and that detail actually for the first time gives you an insight into what actually happened, and it's that detail that you use to rebuild the history.
And Lynette, you mentioned that when you get first-hand accounts, these letters and these other primary pieces of evidence, part of the issue is, you know, memory loss or memory fail or embellishment, that it's contestable evidence. How do you deal with that, given you also want to give these very personal accounts a greater role in telling history?
Well, I usually gather everything that's available, especially if there's several versions, and see where the middle course is. I mean, it's like a road accident today. People see an accident and have 16 different versions from 16 different people. So the biggest thing is to sort out what you think happened, and then go in and interview people after you've sort of got that basis and draw them out and flesh out the story. But the reason I'm interested in the people is that with a lot of the work I do, the numbers are so awful and so large, and the story's so awful, that when you get into the personal level, you make the reader, or at least this is what I try to do, relate to the story as an individual. When they can actually realise that the people that were taking part in these events, 70 years ago in my case and 100 years in James, were flesh and blood, somebody's father, somebody's son, you know, uncle, whoever it was. If you can do that and get your reader to relate to the people in the story as real people, then you've achieved the task of passing on their legacy. And it's that part that interests me more than how many guns people had and what sort of calibre they were.
I want to thank both of you, and well, thank you personally for putting this this energy into history, because we can't really make judgments about the future, can we, without knowing our history. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.